Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Israel Studies. I'm Yaakov Yadgar, and today we are talking to Professor Smadar Lavi on her book Wrapped in the Flag of Israel, Mizrahi Single Mothers and Bureaucratic Torture. Lavi analyzes in this book the racial and gender justice protests movement in Israel. She suggests that Israeli bureaucracy is based on a theological notion that inserts the categories of religion, gender, and race into the foundation of citizenship. The book is now published in a revised and updated edition with a new afterword by the author. Professor Lavi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The book takes the story of Vicky Knafu protest as a case that brings to the fore many of your themes. Can you remind our listeners who is Knafu and what brought her to the center of Israel's public life in the summer of 2003?
Vicky Knafu is a single mother who is Mizrahi. Mizrahim are Jews who immigrated to Israel beginning in 1882, mainly from the Arab and the Muslim world. They constitute about 50% of Israel's citizenry. Some of them also come from the Ottoman margins of Europe. And they are juxtaposed or live together in Israel with 30% Ashkenazim, who are Jews that I guess grouped together because of a linguistic common denominator. They come from Yiddish-speaking countries. And the rest of the citizens are 20% Palestinians who were allowed to stay in Israel after the big expulsion from 1948, where 750,000 from the 900,000 Palestinians who lived in Palestine were expelled in order to make room for the Jewish state on mandatory Palestine. So Vicky is a Mizrahi. She marched on Jerusalem because of neoliberal policies that were enacted by Benjamin Netanyahu when he was the finance minister. These policies cut welfare allowances to mothers to something like $100 a month. These policies were enacted in June, which is what drove her to march. But actually, the law was retroactive and it was to be enacted from January of 2003. So actually, it put single mothers in retroactive debt to the government from January on. So they were left bereft of any kind of welfare support, rent support, etc. So they decided to march on Jerusalem. She started to march. Other single mothers from the far-flung corners of Israel joined her, and they established an encampment called Knafoland in front of the finance ministry in Government Hill in Jerusalem.
So why is her story so important? What its historical meaning?
I don't know if her story in particular is important. I'm an anthropologist, and I work with a decolonized version of the Manchester School case study, in which an anthropologist takes an event that happened in a specific space and draws threads from it to larger social-political, economic, gender and sex, religion and spirituality questions that are threaded into the event itself. So I took CNAFO as a case study of protest in order to show why Mizrahi women or Mizrahi feminists do have agency, but when they enact it, it falls flat. Perhaps because I have my criticism with the social scientists of the progressive variety being very much still tied to the modernist trope of empowering the little guy or the little woman through imbuing them with agency. And I wanted to explore situations where agency falls flat. And I think the CNAFO march and the CNAFO protest movement that ended when a Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up in Jerusalem, where the old 1967 border used to be. And then the mothers just, in for the sake of national unity, they left their encampment and went home. It shows that agency, Mizrahi agency, falls flat when the Palestine-Israel conflict manifests itself. The news and the media get immediately going back to this very comfortable binary of Israel-Palestine that is very easily digestible by the consumers of foreign media. And the relationship between intra-Jewish racism in Israel and the larger context of the Israel-Palestine conflict goes away.
Now, you use CNAFO's story as well as your own autoethnography to present a new concept, that of bureaucratic torture, or of the bureaucracy of the state's welfare system as torture. Now, as you insist, this is not a metaphorical torture, but rather it's a real corporal torture. Can you explain this?
I'm talking about a torture that cannot be expressed in words. It's like pre-discursive. Usually torture is expressed in words, and it's part of the healing also from the torture. But if we explore the Merriam-Webster dictionary first definition of torture, I think it calls for it defines it as an anguish of the body and mind, or something that causes agony or pain. And then epidemiologists draw direct lines between chronic bureaucratic entanglements, hypertension, chronic pain, and death. So the manner in which bureaucracy is used as a tool of governance or a tool of creating a docile citizen body among both Jews and Palestinians in Israel is a major state crime. And this kind of torture, or part of the legal definition or human right definition of torture, is major state crime. So if we take the Webster-Merriam definition of torture, the epidemiological study on the impact of bureaucracy on people's bodies and people's health, it's a cumulative impact. It kills you every day bit. And we take the definition of major state crimes and we look at the death rate, the premature death rate of single mothers in Israel from stress-related ailments. That's torture. Furthermore, oftentimes, in order for women to get their benefits from the welfare officials, they are pressed into giving sexual favors to the clerk, most often a blowjob that is done in his office. oftentimes when the children are present. Sometimes when the welfare official does a home visit to verify the conditions of need, the mother and her children feel obliged to provide sexual favors to the welfare official. That's torture as well. It's sexual torture. It's sexual abuse. When I came out with my data, and I have over 100 interviews of women who testify as to providing, being pressed to provide sexual favors in lieu of favor of welfare, people defined me as extremist, and they just said that I'm hallucinating, and it can't be that this is taking place in a welfare state such as Israel. A year ago, a group of single mothers who are also housing right activists produced a photographic exhibit of their condition, and also a very central figure in Israel mainstream media, Amnon Levy, produced a film where he interviewed survivors of sexual abuse by welfare officials, and the women provide testimonials of the situation of them as little girls being forced to have sex with welfare officials, and their mothers being forced to have sex with welfare officials, and then them as welfare mothers repeating the cycle because it's intergenerational. So now no one anymore tells me that I'm extreme and hallucinating, because it was documented by a top journalist from Israel's mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, moving on to another theme, another central theme in the book, one of the most interesting chapters in the book has to do with the question of a question that seems to baffle the Israeli left, namely the Mizrahi historical support for the political right in Israel. By the left's own self-understanding, Mizrahim voting for the right are actually hurting their own interests, and they should vote for the left. You depict a rather different historical and political picture. Can you present your argument in some detail on this regard?
Yes. Zionism, from its onset, had a very strong streak of socialism coming from Eastern Europe before and after the Russian Revolution. Eastern Europe has a very strict racial classificatory order. If you also go and visit Jewish museums in major cities in Lithuania, where there were, I mean, which are the birthplace of Zionist thinkers like Vilnius, like Kaunas, or like Riga, it throws light. And you look at the segregation and racial classification that Eastern Europeans make between Europeans and white Europeans and other Europeans. And you also look at their zero refugee acceptance policy nowadays. You understand how that kind of racial typification traveled to Zionism. So it was the socialist Zionist left that created the ideology of racial classification and enacted it in form of policy, because the socialist Zionist left was the one behind the foundation of the State of Israel, the one behind the labor union, and the whole ideology of socialism. In which the Mizrahim sometimes were called like little dark domestic animals, as far, and other times, like one famous socialist leader gave a speech in which he encouraged the Chalutzim, or the pioneers, not to rape their domestic Yemeni servants. Mizrahim, the Yemeni laborers at the time, were dealt with violent measures harsher than the Palestinian laborers, because the Palestinians had the know-how, given that they were the indigenous population. So in some points, the Zionist colonizers depended on them. So Mizrahim have a very long memory on For example, the harsh violence with which their attempts to unionize in 1922 as farm workers were encountered, their expulsion from places which are like the Mayflower migration sites of the Zionist socialist movement like Kibbutz Kinneret, and then the way that they were rejected from the pre-state military effort of organizing, from organizations like the Haganah, the Palmach. They were only accepted as like look-alike Arabs doing spy jobs, while the extreme right organizations such as Irgun or the Stern Gangs, the Lehi, used Mizrahi ghettos and barrios to hide weapons from the British. And this kind of gives you prestige points in the narratives of Zionism. Then it was Ben-Gurion and the labor who orchestrated the mass migration, the transit camps, the physical and sexual abuse that occurred in the transit camps, the kidnapping of Mizrahi babies and selling them for adoption. It was labor members who orchestrated the unconsented medical experiments on Mizrahim in the 50s. So Mizrahim have a very long memory as far as the left talking about socialism, but it was a socialism which was white privilege. Wait, let's stop here. Let me recall. One of the main items on the Zionist agenda that created a big class gap was the reparation to Holocaust survivors from Germany. So when these reparations were given to Israeli industries, again run by Ashkenazim, they basically saved Israel from becoming an economy of a banana republic and getting big national debt. However, Holocaust survivors themselves got reparations in hard cash, in Deutsche Marks. The people to note that this is going to create an unresolvable class gap came from the right, not from the left. Menachem Begin was one of the major opponents of the Shilumim or the reparations, not only because he was from Poland, and because of the Polish memories of Auschwitz, Birkenau, etc., but because of his vision of equity and class relations, even though he was, on the whole, for a free market economy. So a main Likud figure, a Holocaust survivor by the name of Dov Shilansky, he comes from Shauli in Lithuania. Unlike the majority of Jews in Shauli who were socialist, he was a Jabotinskyite. And at that point, he worked as a car mechanic. So he did the homemade bomb, and in the temporary residence of the Knesset, he was to be a suicide bomber. And the date that the Knesset was voting for the reparation, he wanted to blow himself up. And he was caught as he was putting the jacket with the dynamite on himself at the toilet of the Knesset and was put to jail. And the reparation payments law passed. In jail, he studied by correspondence to become a lawyer. And he ended up the chairman of the Knesset. Mizrahim do remember that because the access to home ownership in Israel and living in good areas where there are good schools and good civic services is in direct relationship to the access to reparation money. And reparation money also gives intergenerational wealth, and the intergenerational passing of wealth is what facilitates home ownership in Israel. And home ownership is also racially divided between Ashkenazim and Mizrahim.
As you stressed already at the opening of your book, Knafus protest failed. And this indeed is just one case in a long list of social protests in Israel that have failed. How should we understand this history of failed social activism in Israel?
I think that from the rebellion of Yemeni farm workers in 1922 through the rebellion of Wadi Salib in the 50s, the Black Panthers, etc., Israel would have been always on the verge of a civil war between the Mizrahim and Ashkenazim. And one of the ways to pacify or temporarily mend the seams, the racial seams between Ashkenazim and Mizrahim, is through creating a feeling of unity. There is even like a pop tune song, which was very popular after the 73 war, called Am Echad Lev Echad, Kulanu Beyachad Am Echad, which is one people, one heart. All of us, let's sing, one people. So Israel uses the tool of war. Since most wars started, big scale war or operations against Palestinians started by Israel, not as a response, but were initiated as Israel by Israel, aside from 1973, which is an exception. It's very interesting if you put on a time scale the history of social protest in Israel and the history of major wars and operation against Palestinian and Arab states in Israel. And just by putting them on a time scale, you see that whenever there is a social unrest in Israel, a war breaks out. And then both Mizrahim and Ashkenazim unite as a last line of Jewish defense in a sovereign Jewish state against the goyim or the Arab enemy. And basically, the protest movement disintegrates. I can give you an example from Gaza 2014. There is a coalition of Mizrahi organizations called Halo Nechmadim, the not so nice. And in English, they're called the New Black Panthers. Black Panthers after the Black Panthers of Oakland and the Black Panthers of the 70s. And Halo Nechmadim is the not so nice or the not so cute, is the term that Golda Meir used to define, I mean, a belittling terms of the Black Panthers of the 70s. Halo Nechmadim organized against gentrification in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv had several Palestinian villages that were populated by Mizrahim. One of them is Jamusin, and it's called Givat Amal Bet, or B, like Labor Hill. It's like a vestige of Israel socialism in naming places. And actually, it doesn't sit in the margins of Tel Aviv, but it sits in a primetime real estate land between Ichilov Hospital and the military central command, or like the Tel Aviv Pentagon. And but it is a bunch of shacks, and it has been subject to the same residential regulations as refugee camps in the West Bank, which comes from the British. So people from Givat Amal Bet received orders for expulsion, demolition of their homes, and expulsion. A group of activists organized, and what was interesting is that now that some of the pro-Palestine activists, like Anarchists Against the Fence, who are mainly Ashkenazi Jews, and kids from the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, who act as human shields to the West Bankers, also streamed to Givat Amal Bet, and they prepared for mass demonstrations that was to happen in the spring, in the late spring and early summer, against the planned expulsions and demolitions. Now, why summer? Summer is a good time for Mizrahi or Israeli protest because the kids are out of school. You can take them and build tents. If you go and have like a tent protest, it saves your kids from sending them to like summer camp, because good Ashkenazi souls will come and volunteer and get your kids busy. And summer also is when people are served with eviction notices, assuming that in the summer, they have the kids, they will not have time to organize and protest, and they will look for new apartments or new residents for the beginning of the school year in the fall. So these people were very serious. They threatened to blow themselves up in front of the houses to be demolished. They accumulated like gas canisters, and they did Molotov cocktails. And of course, the Israeli internal security always has informers in this kind of movements. This kind of movements are possible when there is a lull in the Israel-Palestine conflict, because the Israel-Palestine conflict usually dominates the news. Internal news about Mizrahim make it to the international media only when there is a lull in the regular conflict. And indeed, there was a lull in the conflict coverage in winter, spring of 2014. Can you imagine how it would be televised to the world that a bunch of Jews of color, together with pro-Palestine activists, are blowing themselves up in front of the caterpillars that are demolishing Jewish homes and a synagogue in central Tel Aviv? So there was something that was for concern for those entities who plan the national mood of Israel and decide what goes in the media, what doesn't go in the media. And they do have a national mood planning division in part of their intelligence, as it was exposed to the media during the Oslo years, as far as preparing the Israeli national mood for signing an agreement with Arafat that all of a sudden became a kosher kind of figure. For the Oslo Agreement in 1993. At any rate, what the government also wanted to pass is this kind of irregular addition to the arrangement law, or Chok HaEsderim, which is like neoliberalism in its best. And the government prepared to pass it in early summer, and they knew that it's going to face resistance and mass demonstration, probably on the scale of the 2011 protest movement, that was like the Israeli version of international Occupy. What they wanted to do is to privatize 49% of the Israeli military industries, 49% of the Israeli national electrical industries, 49% of the Israeli train and port authorities, and they actually started selling them in the stock market outside Tel Aviv. This would not have flown very well together with more austerity measures in the Israeli public. So the way to squelch any possible resistance was to start a war. And indeed, the moment that the activists of Halo Nechmadim were served with what's called Tzav 8, Tzav 8, or Order 8, which is like emergency drafting of Israelis to the military in preparation for war. Some of them were harassed with old parking tickets and old bills that accrued interest and fines. And the whole atmosphere in Israel, particularly after the kidnap of the three boys, was an atmosphere of war and national unity. So that resistance fell flat. And lo and behold, on the second day of the Gaza 2014 operation, the Knesset passed with overwhelming majority all of these privatization measures and measures, further austerity measures as far as healthcare, single mother allowances, and welfare allowances. Israelis paid attention to the war. And even the Israeli media reported about this in the news like a couple of weeks after they've passed. So basically, it was fait accompli. I mean, furthermore, the Knesset members managed to arrange themselves a pay raise during the Gaza war, while they were petitioned by 25,000 people not to arrange for themselves for their habitual pay raise, because so many people were on furloughs and took pay cuts because they were drafted into the reserve. So what was obtained was destruction of the resistance of Halo Nechmadim, national unity and further cuts in Israeli welfare authorities, and selling 49% of the Israeli military industries to private investors who ended up being like Israelis who are invested in the Singaporean stock market, who are buddies from the military elite unit days of main figures of Israeli arms dealers who are also in the political circuit. Yes.
The new edition of your book offers the readers a new afterword, taking the readers through the 2014 war, which you just mentioned in Gaza, to the present. What argument are you making in the afterword?
The afterword actually dissects the two timelines from Occupy 2011, which failed, to Halon Echmadim and Givat Amal Bet on the one hand, and from the operation that the Israeli military, I forgot the name of it, had in 2011, right when the Occupy movement happened, which made it fall flat, to Gaza 2014. So I'm looking on the interplay between the intra-Jewish relationship and the development of the protest movement of Gaza, I mean, of Halon Echmadim, which was run and still is run by Mizrahi feminists, and the international affairs with Israel, Palestine, and the region, which is basically the Saudi, Egyptian, Israeli, American alliance vis-a-vis the Palestinians in Gaza, the Hezbollah and the Hamas. And I'm looking at the fact that basically Gaza 2014 cannot be separated from internal affairs. And it is like the ultimate example of my book, that one cannot look at the international relations aspects of Israel-Palestine or Israel and the Arab world without understanding the intra-Jewish dynamics of the Mizrahi-Ashkenazi rift and the germinal role that women or Mizrahi feminists play in it.
Professor Lowy, we've taken way too much of your time. Can you please tell us in closing what project you're currently working on?
The Wrapped in the Flag started basically as a chapter in a book I was working on, which is called Crossing Borders, Staying Put, Mizrahi Feminism and the Racial Formations of Israel. I went to Manchester, the birthplace of the Manchester case study, and I presented the chapter, and my colleagues there told me, listen, you have a book. You have to do A, B, C, D, and you'll have the book. So basically the years I spent on converting Wrapped from a chapter to a book were a distraction from this book. In this book, I'm looking at how can you be right-wing and anti-racist feminist, which is a state of feminism in Israel. Why many Mizrahi feminists or many Mizrahi women will tell you, yes, Zionism is racism, and it's a racism directed towards Mizrahim. But on the other hand, they tell you, of course, a Jewish state, even though it's mandatory Palestine. Because the Ashkenazim have options, they over 1 million Ashkenazi Jews equipped themselves with European Union passports, just as a safety parachute, if things in the villa in the jungle, which is the Ashkenazi definition of Israel, don't seem to work out. And then the Mizrahi feminists will tell you, where will we go? To Tunisia, to Iraq, to Iran, to Yemen? We are staying, and we need to protect what we have. So I'm looking at this kind of a very paradoxical feminist predicament. And how, in a sense, it has the right wing has served Mizrahi communities, and also there is a gap between the feminist Mizrahi feminist leadership and Mizrahi women, because the feminist leadership actually understands, I mean, thinking very similar lines to the Ashkenazi intelligentsia about the Israel-Palestine conflict. That is, they are divided between socialist Zionists, post-Zionists, and anti-Zionists, which are exactly the divisions of the Ashkenazi left. However, they are way more sensitive to the relationship between Mizrahi-Ashkenazi race relations and the Palestine conflict. And they have a dilemma because their communities are right-wing, because of the reasons I mentioned, or the history of the left in establishing, creating, and feeding the Ashkenazi racism against Mizrahim. So when you run an NGO, you have projects. And for the projects, you need to have constituencies, because the projects are what you get funding with. And Mizrahi feminists decided to have a strategic silence on the question of Palestine so that they can run projects in the Mizrahi communities, which are right-wing. So I'm looking at all of these dynamics of right-wing constituencies, left of center, even way left of center, Mizrahi feminist leadership, and the concessions and compromises and middle grounds that they need to find in order to run a movement. And today, Mizrahi feminism is the largest movement in Israel because it compasses women from all walks of life, starting from unemployed single mothers and ending with underemployed Mizrahi faculty women in Israeli academic institutions, small business owners, attorneys, accountants, factory workers, etc. Because it's a feminism that is mainly dedicated to the betterment of everyday life of Israeli women as far as health, safety, education, employment rights or labor rights, while other Israeli feminisms are way more sectarian, or they have a topic that they deal with, like peace or rape prevention or trafficking women and children, while Mizrahi. And these are like topics that not so much affect the everyday fabric of life of women in ghettos and barriers. And Mizrahi feminism deals with the everyday, and that's how it managed to generate such a large movement of women from the whole, mainly from the whole political gamut of the Israeli politics, though mainly, again, the Israeli public is moving all the time to the right, because in a sense, it's a very reconciliatory feminism. And I'm looking at the price that the feminist leadership pays in order to work in such a large coalition that seems to do good for mainly mothers and children who are Mizrahi, and in that sense, also to Klal Israel.
Sounds like a most interesting project. I'm looking forward to reading this. Smadar Avi, thank you for participating in the show.
Thank you.